You're listening to the best of the Rick Emerson Show. We return tomorrow with a brand new program. This is the Emerson News Network.
To you. It is 17 minutes after the hour of one in this, the month of August of the year of our Lord 2010. Thank you for coming along, making a part of your listening day. We are live from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network. Thank you for joining us on this Monday. It is the Rick Emerson Cavalcade of Whimsy, a series of amusements unparalleled in all of human history. How lucky you are. It's 503-505-6964 if you'd like to join us today. 503-505-6964. Here's the thing about A League of Their Own. If you watch that now, I know I sound corny when I say this, just as good as the day it came out. It's fantastic. And really one of the few movies featuring Madonna that isn't just like a huge festering pile of bad.
Was that opening aimed at me?
Oh, wasn't that aimed at... Yes, it was aimed at you. Yes, I'm sending you secret private messages only you can hear, Don.
Did you pick that specifically to just tell me that, you know...
That there's no crying in baseball?
Yes.
No, but if you'd like to take it personally, feel free to go ahead and do so. In fact, if you're going to take it personally, it seems like I probably can't stop you. So, let's find out right now. Let's just establish here at the beginning of the program. Is Don Taylor going to be taking the opening of the show personally?
I was saying I shared with you earlier, I was feeling a little emo.
Yes.
And then what do you do for the opening? It's that.
Yes, because my clone... Because I, am here in front of you the entire time, and you can see exactly what we're doing. And in fact, I'm busy engaging in witty banter with you during Legion of News. So what I did is I contrived to have a secret version of me, not unlike a recent film starring Christian Bale. I had a secret version of me off in another room, actually finding, downloading, editing, and then bleeping out the profanity. From the League of Their News, the League of Their Own opening, and then coming in here and sticking it on the computer while I distracted you with a bumblebee.
You have so many things though already there. I mean, come on, you have like the opening to Heart to Heart.
Well, that's true, but that's Heart to Heart though. This is League of Their Own. You have to go looking for that.
I was going to do this other opening, but
no.
I'm gonna send Don a message. I'm gonna use this one.
No, in fact, here's the thing about that actually. Well, I've talked about this when we first started this version of the show. I mean, there was a good couple of, it was a good maybe a week, 10 days, 2 weeks, something like that, where some of the watches, like you would say, like, now penis watch, clown watch, Obama watch, and I would just say, like, let me see if I have that, because it was a bunch of my archival stuff that just, for some reason, it's hard to believe this, I know, but for some reason, at the end of the KUFO gig, I was just feeling a little dispirited about radio and thinking that I might not return.
Huh.
Thinking that I might opt to go sell seashells by the seashore instead. So, unlike previous gigs, like at Entercom, for example, where the writing was on the wall, but also I figured, you know, I got to get a job somewhere else. Maybe I should pack up all of my irreplaceable bits and belongings and just stick them on a drive somewhere. Like at Entercom, when they fired me at Entercom, doesn't matter. You know what I took off my desk? Like a pen. Like, I'm taking this pen and this paddle game and this ashtray, and that's it, and you all can suck one. And then I just left. Because, you know, I figured I would get another gig at some point, but I had all my crap already at home. At KUFO, let's have no illusions about this. At KUFO, everybody knew the hammer was coming down. I told the story about how Court and I, apparently on the same night but at separate times during the evening, he and I were both in the office packing up all of our stuff earlier that week because we both figured that we were going to get blown out. We both figured we were going to get whacked. And I'm like, you know what, F this. I'm not going to be the guy schlepping a big box of stuff home. I'm going to take everything up. I'm going to do the Tim Riley. Just take it all home in a shoulder bag. So I packed it, but that's all, like, physical stuff, like my skull. You know, there's no bastard. There's no dick who gets himself photographed staring dreamily out a window is going to get my skull. So that's going home with me. So I went up and I put all my stuff in my bag, took it all home. But all of my, the watches, a lot of our worst songs ever. A lot of our board set, like my soundboard sound effects, that stuff. I had to create all of the stuff from scratch or go find it in my archives, which are like deep, deep in my basement in like a big ass filing cabinet that's behind a bunch of other crap at home. Also, though, in that collection of things are all my opening speeches. So now I have very, very few of those. Now, wow. It's not like I'm not saying that I'm finding a brand new one for every day or that I'm finding stuff I've never used before. But often I have to go search stuff up. So I don't really have, it's not like I have hundreds of those just sitting around.
Okay.
I think I'm like three or four ahead at any given moment. So like right now I gotta get them done through like Thursday. So if you'd like to request one, if you want to request a movie sequence or speech or whatever for a show open, you let Rick Emerson know. He'll hook you up, baby. All right.
That's nice.
Well, in any event, if you would like to engage with us telephonically, it's 503-505-6964, 503-505-6964. That is the telephone number for this, the Rick Emerson radio program. With your comments, questions, death threats, musings of an ironic nature, haiku, limerick, iambic pentameter, whatever it is you might have. You can also email if you like. It's rick@rickemerson.com, rick@rickemerson.com, or you can email Don Taylor, who sits across the table from me each and every weekday, providing the yang to my yin, the yoga to my John, the sunshine to my moon glow. That is Don@rickemerson.com. Here's what's coming up today. We got a snuff watch on the way, corpse watch on the way, taser. Who died? Really? Somebody died? All right.
Yeah,
snuff watch on the way, corpse watch on the way, taser watch on the way. Mr. Ryan White, music editor from The Oregonian, will join us later on the day. We'll do his top five. The top five songs to which he would brood or sulk as a young man. So those are coming up. Let's see what else. We got to recap Mad Men. Did you watch Mad Men last night?
I did indeed.
All right. So we'll talk about Mad Men. We're not going to talk about True Blood. I mean, you can talk about True Blood, but here's the thing. It's going to be the sound of one hand clapping.
I got nothing to say about it.
Have you even finished last night's True Blood?
No.
Hey, can I just tell you how much I don't regret getting off that train? I don't regret. Here's what I don't understand. Let me ask you this, Don Taylor. I don't understand why you continue to watch it. Now, I'm not saying that you got to be beholden to everything I do and like your whole life has to revolve around Rick Emerson. And that I'm not saying that you are the Deimos to my Mars or something. But I am saying that it seems like I watched True Blood the first season because you recommended it to us, which is not a thing I regret. First season, great. Second season, I dig Michelle Forbes. I can forgive a lot from Michelle Forbes. You know, she's there. It makes everything else sort of tolerable. This third season, I watched maybe the first however many, five or six episodes, however many it was, and I don't think I would have made it past. I think I would have quit at the end of season two of True Blood had it not been for the show. I think that became a thing that I was watching just because it's a show that a lot of people watch, and so I wanted to be able to talk about it. But I don't know if you were the same way, but I do know that you didn't watch last week. You didn't finish last week, and I know you haven't finished last night, and I'm not watching it anymore, which means we're not really talking about it on the show. So as a result, I got to ask, what is your deal?
It was one of those things. I got up really, really early this morning. I had a lot of things to do, and as is my wont, I get up in the morning on Monday morning. I seek out Mad Men from the night before, and I watch that. And then I came in here to the office early because I knew Greg and Sarah would not be here this morning. So I came in to have a nice, quiet little office time. And I was doing some stuff. And I realized it's like, True Blood was on. I could go acquire that. And then I could watch it in a tiny little window of the corner of my computer.
I could watch
while I'm surfing news.
I could watch a terrible resolution version of the show on a screen the size of a matchbook.
Well, yeah, and that's the thing. It's like it would be like watching, a small TV on the other side of the room or something. You know, it's like, so I'm like,
Which I can understand if you were watching something of quality. You know, if Lawrence of Arabia was suddenly on or something. I mean, but
it was just curiosity is really all it was. Just mild curiosity.
I don't care. It's not like it's any skin off my teeth. It doesn't really matter to me.
I didn't feel the need to maintain it.
I'm just saying that it's like I was at a BBQ on Saturday.
I was as well.
Were you?
A different one though.
My God. Wait, where was yours? Was yours like a work thing?
Mine semi-work. It was at Fat Boy Robert's home with his lovely girlfriend and a number of people.
Yeah, no, I went to this thing. It was at some friends of Lara, so we went to the Soapbox Derby, which was great, but goddamn, it just gets hotter up there every year. I think there's like something where global warming is only true on Mount Tabor or whatever, or it's just getting closer to the sun somehow. It is unbelievably hot. She's up there, and fortunately, we only went for the end. And I know that all the cool cars are at the beginning, and all the cool soapbox stuff is at all the art stuff is at the front. But it's, it's either that or sleeping in, and sleeping in wins most of the time. So we went to the Snowbox Derby, and then we went to, she has some friends who live right at the base of Mount Tabor, so we went to a barbecue there, and a couple that we know, they own a couple of video stores, and they're also just big pop culture junkies, so they're always, you know, they're always just sort of power loading a lot of movies and TV shows, and we always fall into just having sort of, you know, the sort of like, well, you know this, you were Bobby's house, the sort of half discussion, half argument about whatever. And so it's like this guy and my wife got into it about weeds, and then it was then we were talking about Justified, which I guess we're all sort of on board with Justified. But then we were talking about True Blood, and with this whole argument about whether it's because. See, and here I am talking about the goddamn show again, even though I don't really care. True Blood has become one of those things. True Blood has become not unlike the third season of Californication, which, while terrible, was fascinating to me. For reasons that had nothing to do with the quality of the writing. Just like just the discussion about the show and the show's dynamic itself is way more interesting than the actual show. Because we got into this big argument about whether or not True Blood was intentionally camp, third season. Whether they were steering into it and trying to make it kitschy, or whether it was still accidentally kitschy. And I said that I just felt like they were trying way too hard. It was sort of like the difference between an artist and an artisan. Creating something and then looking at a blueprint and trying to replicate it. And I think that's what they're doing at this point, which is why I quit.
And that's part of the thing is, like, when I said I'm watching it out of curiosity, it's not like I'm... And like I said, I didn't watch all of last week's episode or all of this week's episode. I'm not watching it because I'm absorbed by the story or I give a damn about any of the characters or even that I'm being entertained by it. It's more like I'm observing it. I turned around to watch it
to just
kind of see, okay, what weird crap are they going to do this week? You know, it's like I'm looking at the mechanics of the show and not really actually enjoying
okay, no,
it.
Okay, no, fair enough. It's to go back to this, and we were talking about, what the hell time is it? 1:28. All right.
I did want to tell you one quick story about, yes. And it's very quick, but about being at Bobby's house this weekend.
Before you do that, let's find out what headlines you're tracking today,
and then we'll
actually get into the rest of what we did last night.
Okay.
Don Taylor's tracking the following headlines for you on this Monday.
The Craigslist killer suspect, Philip Markoff, committed suicide. Former Eugene mayor, Mayor Bascom, was injured in a crash. And a man who agreed to save his brother's life by donating part of his liver died 4 days after the transplant.
Oh, chose poorly. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So blah, 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 Bobby Roberts, blah, 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 barbecue. You, Don Taylor, what?
Yeah, so I'm there at this barbecue, and Adam Roscoe, a bunch of the Atomic Arts people, because Bobby was in Trek in the Park. So a bunch of the Atomic Arts people were there. And Adam Roscoe was there, and I said, oh, hi, we talked on the show. You did a phoner with the Emerson show, blah, blah, we're talking. So I'm talking to him and sitting around with him and Mike Russell from the Oregonian, and we're talking. And Mike asks him if, you know, any kind of weird fan sort of things have happened now that, you know, they've been doing Trek in the Park.
Are there Trek in the Park groupies?
Well, yeah, and he tells this story that is really not my story to tell, so I won't go into too much detail, but basically about some young ladies coming to the show with their boyfriends and then saying, so what do you guys do after the show? Where do you go? And they're like, we just go to somebody's house and drink beer, and then maybe we'll wander out to this bar. Oh, what bar, they say, and he tells them. And so they go to their friend's house, hang out for a while, and then like 3.5 hours later, they go to this bar, and these girls are sitting there waiting for them.
That's awesome.
And get up and walk over. And I look at him, and I say, so did you take advantage of the situation? And Anna Brosco swivels his head to the side and looks at me with this look of such offense.
A palpable disgust.
Yeah. And he said, no. And it was like, and I just had that moment that you have sometimes when you're talking to people where you just go, why am I even ever let out of the house to be around people?
You have nothing to apologize for there. I'm not saying that it's like, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with his answer. You know, whatever.
I'm just saying he's telling this perfectly lovely anecdote, and then I'm like, so did you do anything about it? So did you get any? I'm just like, I say this incredibly stupid, inappropriate thing.
Here's the thing. If it makes you feel any better, which it may not, because I've learned that really, don't take this the wrong way. I've learned that when you're in one of your moods, that really nothing will make you feel better. But I'm the same way. So that's the thing. You know, if you're going to beat yourself up about something, it doesn't really matter. That's just the road you're going to hoe, and there's nothing I can do. So this may or may not make you feel better, but for what it's worth, I would have asked the same thing.
Yeah.
Now, he
didn't seem to hold it against me. I mean, when I left later, he was bye, Don, nice to see you. He was all friendly.
No, because he's a nice guy. You know, he's a legitimately nice guy. I would have asked, look, you can't, can we just speak as men here, and I'm using that figuratively, just speak as grown-ups. if you're a guy who has achieved, his current fame, and I'm sure he's going to go on to great things. He's a good guy, and I've talked to him a few times. He's obviously going places. But his current fame is largely tied to Trek in the Park. If you achieve your current fame because you are recreating, line for line, a Star Trek episode at the zoo or whatever, and then girls are indicating that they are sexually interested in you because, again, you recreated, word for word, a Star Trek episode, it is perfectly fair and, I would say, culturally required to ask if you're gonna kind of get your hump on there. Okay. It's exactly what I meant. How can you not? How can you not say, so did you? So
that does make me feel better because I just did immediately just sort of feel like, what's wrong with me? Why do I say things?
And
like
I mean
that?
This in the best way, but no, F him, because I would have asked you the same thing. You, hey, Helen nerd, did you take advantage of the free and easy sex that was offered your way, for being in Star Trek? I would completely have asked that. And if you look at it, you have nothing to be ashamed of there, Don. And I'm not saying he does it. I mean, there's nothing wrong with his answer. I'm not saying it's like I think it's silly he didn't or whatever. I don't care. I'm just saying that is a thing that everybody would have asked. You were doing the Larry King there. You were asking the simple, direct question that inexplicably, though, no one probably would have asked. Christopher Reeve, can you have sex? There you go. You're the Larry King of the Rick Emerson Show. Let's see. What else do we have? Okay, so here's what's coming up. We got Aaron Duran of GeekInTheCity.com will be doing the Week in Geek today. Ryan White of the Oregonian will be here. We'll talk about his top five songs to which he would brood as a young man. Let's see. I've got three great stories here, actually, that I... Now, you already read the goddamn Tila Tequila story. I should have known that you would be privy to it. You'd have it. I actually set it aside, though, but here's what you probably don't have, Dawn Taylor. You probably don't have the version of the Tila Tequila Insane Clown Posse story, and how glorious that I get to say that, that has all the message board comments from the Juggalos.
Oh, no, that I don't have. I do have a picture of her that she posted of herself showing off her injuries.
Hi, I'm a gremlin. I got a tiny face.
God, she's creepy.
She's horrifically ugly. And I'm, whatever. Call me a sexist or
whatever. In every sense of the word.
No, that's the thing. Outside, inside... Yeah. Upside, downside, backward, forward, inside, it doesn't matter. She's a troll. And I know that most guys, maybe not most guys, I know a lot of guys are not thought of as being this way. But I will forgive a lot in terms of weird look, personality, sense of humor, talent. You take a homely chick, you put her on stage, if she can sing and play guitar really well, I'm in. That's the thing. So it's not like personality didn't count for anything. You make a chick rich, I am there. a woman who can buy and sell me is like the hottest thing on earth. So she ought to be clinging on the wing of a plane and staring at William Shatner. So anyway, and also I have to say this. I know this will sound retarded, and so I'm just going to go right into that. I got kind of a soft spot for the Insane Clown Posse. For reasons that we can talk about later. It's not really important, but anyway. So I got the Tila Tequila Clown, Insane Clown Posse thing. I got this. This is like an Onion thing, where the rest of the story is probably not that good, but it's all about the headline. Man kills friend, drinks his blood. I haven't even read the rest of the story, but it's like, do you need to? You know it's genius. What else? Let's see. I've got this. Did you see this thing about the truck at an off-road race that drove right into the crowd?
No.
Yeah.
No, I missed that one.
Oh. Well... If only he'd missed them, Dawn. Let's see what else. Well, and a bunch of other stuff. So, and we'll talk about Mad Men last night, which was great and all that. I made some notes to myself from this weekend. I'm not going to get to a lot. Some of this we'll have to wait on. I will say, that summer's really, truly here. I mean, it took months because we had the whole January thing, and then last month it was sort of rainy and drizzly. But it's been pretty warm the last few days. Here's the thing. My house will be cool when I get home because the air conditioner's running right now, keeping my dog cool. And then when I get home and I'm going to walk in, it's going to be a perfect 72 degrees when I walk in the front door. Here's the thing. Can I just tell you all this? I woke up in the middle of the night last night. I had to get up and go put on like a long sleeve shirt. It was too chilly in my room. I made some notes from this weekend, and I'll just do like a couple of them here. First of all,
can I mention also later in the show I will have my installment of Confidential to That Guy.
Yes, we have a new feature on the Rick Emerson radio program. It's Confidential to That Guy, in which we alert a member of society that his actions are not in keeping with being a decent human being. But here's the first sign that summer is actually truly here, however brief it may be, and that is I went to Plaid Pantry, and for the first time this year, when I bought something for $6 and I gave the guy $20, got a handful of damp money out of the register.
Oh, nice.
Damp bills.
Ah.
There you go. And normally that's a thing that I give. I give the dampness. I don't receive it. And you feel bad, but at the same time, you're glad to be getting rid of the damp money, aren't you? Like, here you go, sir, 5, 6, and 7. Sorry, they're damp.
Oh.
And you know that guy's just thinking, they're going, God damn, I hate you. Stupid customer. Stupid damp money having customer.
Speaking of the Trek of the Park guys, Jesse Groff, who played Spock, he works at a Plaid Pantry. He talks about it on his Twitter occasionally.
No, it's a sad existence.
Yeah, it seems to be everything you would think. That
oh no, I worked at a 7-Eleven in San Diego, and in a not particularly desirable part of town, from midnight to 6. So you know, I'm sure that experience hasn't changed a whole lot. Anyway, so I got a handful of damp money, soapbox derby, and then. You know what I brought to the barbecue, because it was like a potluck style thing.
Triscuits?
No. Well, close. Here's the thing, and it wasn't my fault this time. It was a potluck, and the guy was barbecuing. You know how the deal is. Like, he's making the main course. Everybody else is supposed to bring sides or dessert or whatever. We were supposed to bring a pasta salad, but the deal is we were going directly from the house to the park for the soapbox derby to his house. And it's like you can't just leave pasta salad. You know, like, even for me, you don't want to leave that sitting in the sun for 3 hours and eat it. Even I might not do that. And I say, we should just hit, look, it's tacky, but let's go to, like, Fred Meyer, Safeway. We'll go to the deli, bring some purchased pasta salad. Not that it's bad, but I'm saying, you know, instead of making our own, we'll just stop and get some.
Don't you have one of those little individual-sized, like, sort of lunchbox-sized coolers?
I don't know.
Pasta salad?
Do I look like I have breasts? That is not a thing I know. I'm not saying it's ladies' work, but I'm saying in my home, that is the work of the lady of the house. Not because it's her job. It's because she likes to do that. I like to do it. She likes to cook. Guess what? You get to cook. But I actually said, look, we didn't have any pasta salad made. You know, that we don't want to be stooges. Let's just stop by 7-Eleven or Safeway or whatever, and we'll just pick up, you know, something for the deli. She actually says, no. We'll just go to a convenience store. And I said, you know, there's no pasta salad at the convenience store unless you found some secret convenience store that I haven't, you know, not aware of. And it wasn't even like we went to a 7-Eleven. We went to one of those, you know, it's like some Vietnamese guy and there's bars on the window, you know, or whatever. And it's, you know, and it's got like, you know, it's got the character riding out front. It's a guy named Han with a shotgun behind the counter. And if you stop moving, you know, like, have you ever been to one of those convenience stores where, and I hate to stereotype, but in my experience, this is usually a thing where there is an Asian proprietor.
And the inside of the store always smells like moldy air conditioning and Smarties.
Yes. But it's the thing where if you linger, and this happens to me less and less as I get older, but if you linger for even a moment, there's the suspicious voice behind the counter, you know, what you buy? You know, and it's just like, I'm just looking, sir. You know, it's not a library. You buy, you go. You know, so we're in this convenience store, and so Laura just says, well, why don't we just get some Pringles? I'm like, baby, they're expecting us to have brought a homemade pasta salad dish. You can't bring Pringles. And she's like, no, it'll be fine. And so with that permission, I just went and I just bought a bunch of, like, bagged crap from the convenience store. I bought the most glorious snack that I didn't even know it existed. And I went in the space of 5 minutes, not knowing it existed, to it being my new god. It's like that time I went through this phase where I ate chocolate Chex Mix, but then I burned out on it. You know what I had over the weekend, Don? Chocolate peanut butter Bugles. Now, they don't sound like they would be good.
Oh, yes, they do.
Here's the thing. They're even better than you can imagine.
They sound amazing.
They are even better than your tiny human mind can conceive. You have no idea. I actually wish that I had never tasted them. I wish that I did not know how. I wish that no man had known what I knew now with the knowing and the. Anyway, they're good. This is a thing. They're awesome. So
yeah, I went to somebody's house a couple of months ago, and they had these things from from Trader Joe's, and they were chocolate covered the little mini Ritz cracker sandwiches.
Yeah,
with the peanut
butter. I know what you're talking about there.
And so I went, and they were like, "These are awesome!" And it's a package like this. It's only 99 cents. So like a couple of weeks ago, went back to Trader Joe's, couldn't find them. Asked the guy, "Oh yeah, we don't have those anymore."
Oh no, we've discontinued that item you liked, sir.
Why? Because they were too awesome.
Yeah. No.
God damn you, Trader Joe's.
damn you to hell. I can make them discontinue foods by doing that. By latching onto something. You know, if to, hey, I really like this Crystal Pepsi. Crap. You know, then it's just gone. Anyway, I'm just saying,
covered peanut butter
here's
bugles.
The thing. We have to make a solemn pinky swear, though. Don't buy any tonight. I'll bring some. And if Patrick gets them, don't eat them. Here's the thing. I want you to try them on the air so the audience can hear your ecstasy.
It's so sad. Bugles are one of those things that I can actually remember the first time I ever tasted a bugle. It was on a vacation in Mexico with my family, and we were just south of the border, and my dad had picked up some food at some, you know, store somewhere, and they had bought these bugles, and I'd never had bugles before. I was like about 7 or 8 years old, and I will always remember that. It's like the shape being really unusual, the strange.
Did you
greasiness.
Put them on the end of your fingers?
Yeah, and then actually taste them, just going, oh, this is the best thing I've ever had.
I'm telling you, these chocolate peanut butter bugles are like they're manna from heaven. I mean, it's just they're awesome. So that's all in the way. And it seems like we had the other, well, whatever. I mean, I don't know. It seems like there was other stuff I needed to promote here at the beginning, but I just, it's all escaped me. Well, I should mention this, actually. Or should I? I don't even know. There's a schedule in front of me, but it's covered by other things. It is the definition of out of sight, out of mind.
Well, we didn't.
Don, you have a schedule in front of you. Yeah. Is there something I should be mentioning?
No,
never mind. Well, F that. Yeah. All right, it's 503-505-6964. Let's pay a visit to the news desk with Don Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
A former medical student accused of killing a masseuse he met through Craigslist committed suicide in the Boston jail where he was awaiting trial. Philip Markoff, 24, was found unresponsive in his cell Sunday morning in the Nashua Street Jail, the Suffolk County District Attorney's Office said. This is in Boston. He was pronounced dead at about 10:15 a.m. Markoff was alone in his cell, the statement said, and all evidence collected thus far indicates that he took his own life. Markoff, a former Boston University student, pleaded not guilty in the fatal shooting of Julissa Brisman of New York City and the armed robbery of Las Vegas.
You all know our next guest. His films include Clerks, Chasing Amy, Zach and Mary Make a Porno, and Mallrats. In addition, he can be seen whoring himself relentlessly and without mercy everywhere, including a series of speaking engagements this fall, and online at jayandsilentbob.com, where you can purchase his new book, which we will, for the purposes of broadcast, as governed by the FCC, refer to as Shooting the S, with Kevin Smith. Ladies and gentlemen, the aforementioned Mr. Kevin Smith. Good morning to you, sir.
Sir, let me ask you a question. You're in Portland, yes?
Yes.
Is it as gay as Gus Van Sant depicted it in My Own Private Idaho?
It's even gayer, sir. As we speak right now, there is, in fact, there's a troupe of mimes coming through wearing pink tutus, and they are twirling like a Bjork video.
That movie made me want to go to Portland because it's like, look at all these popular dudes who are gay. I want to be a part of this.
Portland is actually a city where the men all look like women and the women all look like they're there to install aluminum siding at your house.
You're selling me, dude. I'm there.
Thanks for that, Rick. I appreciate it.
No, I mean, present company excluded, sort of. Hey, you were the one yesterday that referred to yourself as being all like, you did look like you were going to be putting on a tool belt.
Some days are better than others.
Every city's got its sterling qualities, and a sort of off-putting yet strangely endearing androgyny is Portland. So,
yeah, man, I'm looking for a visit. I don't think I've been there since like '94.
Well, I was actually going to ask you the geek contingent of the audience would string me up if I didn't ask you this. You know, we got like half the comic industry based fair town.
And Eugene is there, dude, where they shot Animal House. That's a comedy mecca.
And yet,
I still never spent much time in Portland. I don't know why. It's not for personal reasons where I'm like, oh, to hell with Oregon. It's just I've never really had opportunity to do so.
And so you've got, the evening Kevin Smith thing that, tours everywhere. And it's almost like it's like you go out of your way to shun us, Kevin. I mean, I don't want to put it that way. It's almost like
you know what it is, dude? What happens is when you're touring with a movie or something like that, you wind up in Seattle and all the Portland journalists come up. You guys are like the New Jersey of the Northwest.
you cut me to the quick, sir.
Seattle's New York and you guys are like, well, we'll trek in New York because it's easier for everybody else. We don't want to be a hassle. You guys are just like the New Jersey of the Northwest.
Actually, Anthony Bourdain came through and he did a Northwest thing. And we didn't even get our own special. It was like Northwest featuring Portland. We were just sort of under the umbrella of like lots of other towns.
I know. I'm coming out there, I think, in like, I think it's November. Is it November or October 7th? I'm coming out there to do a Q&A very soon, but Seattle. But then in the spring, I'm going to Portland.
Okay, so you will be done. When you say you're coming to Portland spring, is that going to be for the evening with Kevin Smith? Or is
yeah,
it
gonna we're
be...
going to sit up on stage and do that BS where I'm like, hey, ask me questions, and I talk for 3 hours.
You booked Carnegie Hall, actually, with that, right?
I did. In June, I played Carnegie Hall. They had an open slot in their schedule, and these two producers were kind enough to be like, hey, you do college shows where you talk to kids and stuff. Do you want to do that at Carnegie Hall? And I was like, would I? And the dude got really insulted because he had a wooden eye. That's an old joke. I'm sorry. I pulled that right out of my youth. So anyway, I was like, I would love to, and I did it. And not only did we do it, I was like, look, if I'm going to do Carnegie Hall, the only way I'm doing it is if I'm going to try to sell it out. It's no fun to do Carnegie Hall if you see empty seats. So for like 2 months straight, once we found out what the date was, I just hoarded on Twitter, man, and just let people know, these are how many tickets sold, these are how many left. These are, made it a real game, made it like, you know, participation event, and was able to sell it out. And so once that happens, then you got like legitimate theaters across the country suddenly going like, hey, do whatever you do here. And I've been doing it for years. Like, I'm sharpening it for at least a decade at colleges, but nobody ever invited me out of a college campus because I guess they assume that's the only people who really cared. So now I wind up doing all these gigs at legitimate places. Like, I think we're in Seattle, it's the Benaroya Hall or something like that. Is that legitimate?
Yeah, well, the thing about you talking to colleges, actually, when you first went to start doing that, when you're doing the Evening with Kevin Smith stuff, do you have, since you didn't go to college, you went to film school, but then you left and you made Clerks, is it more a sense of, like, I kind of secretly don't belong here, or is it more a sense of, like, in your face, I have no degree and I am wealthy?
It's the middle. It's the middle road, which is like, this is what I would have liked to have done: sit around and talk to students. But this, if I'd gone to college, that's the only aspect of college I think I missed, is the social aspect. But I actually like this way better because it means I lead the conversation all the time by virtue of the fact that I'm the guy that made the movie or blah 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 whatever. So it's, I never go there like in your face, college, particularly because the kids, that would just dishearten the kids to no end, wouldn't it? Where I'm like, in your face, I made it, you didn't. They're like, hey, man, we're still in school, you fat jackass. And I don't feel the other way where it's just what was the other option?
I don't know. We're lost in a thicket of adverbs now. I don't even know where we are, but I will.
It happens, dude, because I smoke a lot of weed in the morning, my bad.
Talking about not going to college, you're also, so you do, sold out Carnegie Hall, and then you were identified on the cover of the new book, the Shootin' the S book, identifies you as, quote, and this is awesome, New York Times best-selling author, Kevin Smith.
It's almost the only reason that this current book exists, because Adam over at Titan, the publisher, he was the guy who was the mastermind behind this book and the other book, which was, I've been writing an online blog for like 2 years. And Titan said, can we publish it? And I said, why would anyone want to, dude? That's old media. It's like, you can read it for free online. Why would anyone want to actually buy the book? And I was wrong. People did want to buy the book. We thought we'd sell like a couple hundred copies to fans, and then somehow it wound up being a New York Times bestseller. So Adam says, we have to do another book, if for no other reason than to just put that on the quote over your face, because nobody's going to believe it, dude. It's hysterical.
It is awesome that whenever I see something like that, I do revel in the sure and certain knowledge that somewhere there is somebody looking at that in a bookstore and becoming angry.
Yeah,
and
probably my mother. My mother going like, he's cursing again. Everyone's going to think I raised him wrong. Why won't he shut his fat mouth?
Why always the potty talk?
Yeah, why can't he work clean like Bill Cosby?
When you were growing up, what was the most that you kind of realistically hoped for before Clerks kind of changed everything?
My big dream in life was to own a deli because I really knew how to make a sandwich. Still do.
That was your it was corned beef and potato salad for miles.
I could do that. I was like, I'm really good. I know exactly how much meat to put on a sandwich where the customer's not like, oh, dude, this is too much, or not like, hey, man, put a little more on that. Good. I'm a fat man. A fat man knows how to make a sandwich, to say the least. So I was like, I can do that. And I'd worked in delis for years. Delis and convenience stores were my thing. So I was like, I imagine one day I'll wind up owning a small deli, and then just because of the sandwich aspect. But then the film thing kicked in.
We're talking to Kevin Smith. One of the filmmakers you've mentioned a lot is Hal Hartley, and I am just an evangelist for a movie called Trust that he made.
That was the movie for me, dude. Like, you know, I always talk about Richard Linklater's Slacker as the movie that made me realize that I too could be a filmmaker. But it was Hal Hartley's trust that really freed me up to write the kind of dialogue I write, because Hal Hartley's trust was porn for a guy like me who loves dialogue, and he was doing stylized dialogue. So it had this surreal quality to it. It was almost like you were watching a theater show or play rather than watching a film. And I didn't ape that style, but because he was able to do that, because I was like, wow, this dude's just taking chances, it made me feel comfortable enough, secure enough to kind of write dialogue the way I write it. I love that movie. It's so delighted you brought that up. Nobody talks about trust, and it's such a great flick.
It is, and the other note on that movie, you watch it now, and it's got this strangely non-dated feel to it, because even then, like, I think about the score, and it's got that weird electro, like, Moog synthesizer.
Yeah, the typical Hal Hartley Ned Rifle score, which is his pseudonym for himself, so he always does the score, and the score, like his writing, is like, it's almost like a Beckett play, it's so Spartan.
It has this kind of strangely off-kilter, angular feel to it that just lends it this kind of timeless quality. It's just a great movie, and that imprint is all over the early stuff that you do. You know, you can sense again that you're not aping it, but that it very much has that kind of what they call the hyper-realistic style.
Hal Hartley's work absolutely informed my work, and I made no secret of that back in the day. I would tell people to drop the hat. I was preaching the gospel of Hal Hartley. Then I read an interview that he did in the New York Times Magazine, and this was like circa 1996. And in it, the author of the piece begins the piece thusly. You know, Hal Hartley, and I can't do it verbatim, essentially it's this. Hal Hartley was at a Q&A, and somebody asked him, hey man, how does it feel to be shouted out in the end credits of Clerks by Kevin Smith? And apparently he gave such an impassioned, vitriolic answer that he had to go lay down after the show.
He was emotionally spent.
He was not a Kevin Smith fan. That's what I got out of the piece.
I see.
Broke my heart, dude, because I was like, oh, but I'm such a huge Hal Hartley fan. It was an important lesson to learn. Sometimes you're going to love people, they're not going to love you back.
Well, I'm sorry to have traumatized you with that. I have to say...
Set up a bad memory, dude.
If I can go out on that negative note, let me just say as we wrap this up here, all kidding aside, on a personal note, I have to say that just for me, that, I saw Chasing Amy, and it resonated with me on such a deep level that it really did truly forever alter the way that I dealt with women in relationships. So I want to thank you for doing what you do for me, for all of us, for everybody who loves film, my friend.
Hey, Seuss Marimba, dude, that was so kind. And so let me tell you something. I'm coming to Oregon now. You sold me.
Well, there
I'm
you go.
I'm hanging out with you, dude. You're complimentary as hell.
I am the city's ambassador, sir.
If I'm there, it's because of you. And if I'm there, I'm totally walking in and sitting in on that show.
That's going to my resume and on my personal file right now. Best of continued success in life, art, and all things, my friend. Thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Talking to you. Absolute pleasure.
There you go. Kevin Smith, ladies.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Emerson Show. We return tomorrow with a brand new program. This is the Emerson News Network.
Why do 45 RPM records have a larger center hole than 33s or 78s?
From the Emerson News Network, this is Pop Culture Authority.
I'm Rick Emerson. It's a deeply ingrained part of the music lover's culture, hunting around for an adapter so you can put on a 45 single. Without the adapter, you're reliant on the weight of the phonograph needle to hold the record in place, of course, and that usually goes poorly. But why the adapter? That is, why the larger center hole at all? Well, money, of course. Specifically, that hallmark of the entertainment industry, the format war. When vinyl records first achieved mass popularity beginning around 1925, the standard speed was 78 rotations per minute. That was a matter of simple mechanics. The most widely used turntable motor just happened to result in a record turning at 78 RPMs, so that's what records were made to do. But as any Betamax or Laserdisc owner will tell you, things always get tricky. Columbia Records decided it wanted customers buying its records and its record player, not someone else's. The solution? Columbia created the 33 RPM record, which could only be used with 33 RPM record players, which, at the time, only Columbia made. RCA, not to be outdone, created the 45 RPM record, and the format war was on. It was all pointless, of course, since, as IBM would find out several decades later, reverse engineering and then cloning technology is fairly simple. Soon, the world was awash in 33s, 45s, and 78s. How would companies make money now? Well, in the case of RCA, they decided to saturate the emerging youth market with their recordings, using the most cutting-edge music-sharing system then available, the jukebox. The jukebox, of course, had to lift those little 45 singles out of the rack, place them on a platter, and play them. All very difficult with the tiny little center hole in most 45s. So, the hole was made larger. So, the next time you're at the head shop, or perhaps a Hot Topic, buying something decorated with the iconic image of a 45 adapter, which is called a spider, by the way, realize that were it not for the greedy, money-grubbing record industry, that product, like most things related to your music, wouldn't exist.
The final word on the only knowledge that matters. Pop Culture Authority from the Emerson News Network.
You all know my next guest. He is the award-winning maker of such films as Bowling for Columbine, Roger and Me, and Sicko. His new release, Capitalism, A Love Story, is playing in Portland, Oregon. Right now, let's welcome now to the Rick Emerson Show, the one and only Mr. Michael Moore. Good morning, sir. How are you on this fine Tuesday?
How are you?
I'm an 8.3 on the 1 to 10 scale. How are you, sir?
Damn, that's pretty good.
Well, I like to face the day with a burnished optimism whenever possible. And I weighed whether or not to actually use this phrase, but you're sort of, in the best way possible, this kind of documentarian Bruno, where it gets harder and harder to catch people unawares. Just as Sacha Baron Cohen can't really surprise people anymore, it's probably harder for you. Has your notoriety made it easier or harder to get these films done the way you want to?
Well, it's actually made it easier because I know what you're saying. It's harder because people recognize me, so I can't get into the corporate executive office as easy. But what is easier is that because people do know me, I get so many tips from the public, so many whistleblowers, so many people sending me documents from the office because they believe that, well, there's one guy who, might stand up for us here. And so that's made it actually easy in a way to do what I do.
When the economic implosion and the meltdown and the bailout all happened, I know that you were, at that point, I think you're beginning pre-production on your next film, on which what became Capitalism, A Love Story, and you actually had sort of an open letter you put out to people who worked on Wall Street or in the financial community saying, look, if you know what happened, if you have the inside story, you got to let me know so I can get the truth out there. When you make specific calls like that, you know, to the public, do you hear back from a lot of people who work in an industry or are in a part of life where they feel the truth needs to get out as they see it?
I received over 22,000 emails from people.
Really?
Literally around the world. All, most of whom I would say work on some level in a bank somewhere, an insurance company somewhere, a real estate company somewhere. Sometimes it was just from a small town. A number of them, though, were from Wall Street. I had a number of VPs or former VPs of places like Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, et cetera, that wrote to me, who gave me a lot of good information and background. A couple of them even agreed to go on camera and did.
Are you ever surprised by the people who either will go on camera or by something that someone says? Do you ever catch yourself being astonished at a moment of unguarded honesty from one of your subjects?
Oh, yeah. I really, when that happens, I'm like, geez, that is really a rare moment here when the truth is coming out.
I've repeatedly compared you to Abbie Hoffman over the years. I remember first when I saw Roger and Me for the first time, and I was just sort of gushing to all of my friends about it. And I was like, you got to see this movie. It's called Roger and Me. And they said, what it's about? And I go, oh, it's about Flint, Michigan, and this guy, he's trying to find Roger Smith from General Motors. And I just kept going back to the Abbie Hoffman thing because he was such an entertainer and so hilarious, but at the same time, it was shot through with all of this sort of pathos and what Chuck D would call a life-loving kind of hate. And it was this sort of righteous indignation mixed together with a very compelling, entertaining side. But who was it that inspired you to become an entertainer? Was it someone like Abbie Hoffman? Was it someone more political, less political? Who kind of lit the fuse for you?
That's a good question. You know, I don't know. I don't know where that moment was. I wish I could put my finger on it. I do know that I've always loved going to the movies, and I, when I first thought of making my first movie, I thought, well, I could do this. You know, I don't really know how to do it, but I've watched enough movies to know what I like. And so that's what I set about doing.
We're talking with Michael Moore. The new film, Capitalism, A Love Story, is playing in Portland, Oregon right now. You mentioned being a lover of movies. What movie do you first remember loving?
My the very first movie I remember liking was PT 109.
PT 109, excellent, good reference, sir.
Is with Cliff Robertson playing young John F. Kennedy about the when he was in World War II and the Japanese boat crashed into his boat and sunk it, and how he saved everybody on the boat.
PT 109, when I was growing up, seemed to alternate with The Sound of Music for being on television. It was just always, every time I walked by the TV, it was either PT 109 or the Von Trapps, or this, you know, sort of singing Edelweiss. At this point in your life, what movie would you say that you have seen more than any other, discounting obviously your own work? What is the most frequently seen movie in the Moore household?
I would say This is Spinal Tap, Life of Brian, Monty Python, A Clockwork Orange, Stanley Kubrick.
Being such, and all of those films have a very exceptional craft to them, and you yourself are a very skilled crafter of sound and imagery, and I'm not saying that just to flatter. Your films really do have this astonishing level of technical expertise. Do you regret that sometimes is overlooked because of your politics?
Oh, yeah, and it really, thank you for pointing that out, because I rarely get to have a discussion with anyone about film or cinema as an art form. It's always about the politics in the film, and it's odd to me, because people think of me as a political person, but if I were doing this just for the politics or for the message, you know, I'd run for office, or I'd start a political organization, or I'd do something else, but I've chosen to be a filmmaker. So first and foremost, I've set out to give you two of the best hours hours I can give you at the movie theater, I want you to walk out at the end of my movie and say to your date or your spouse, or your spouse could be your date, say to this individual, wow, that was a great way to spend 2 hours. That was something. Can you believe what we just saw? I mean, that is what I'm going for, and I think that's why I've been very, very blessed to have as many people go to my movies in the past, because I really am taking a lot of care and concern with giving you the absolute best movie-going experience on a Friday or Saturday night.
The new movie, Capitalism, A Love Story, is playing in Portland, Oregon right now. And from somebody who loves movies to somebody who makes movies, I want to thank you for being out there and doing what you do. Best of continued success in life, art, and all things, my friend.
Well, thank you, Rick. And, you know, you guys, you live really in one of the best cities in the country. I don't know if you know that.
You said it, brother.
I've traveled this great nation, and you live in a wonderful place.
Excellent. Well, thank you, my friend. And we would love to have you back at some point. Best of success with the movie and with everything. Thank you for spending some time with us.
Take care.
Thank you. There you go. Mr. Michael Moore, ladies and gentlemen, the new film Capitalism, A Love Story, playing in Portland, Oregon right now. So there you go.
A brave man beats a man named Fan with a fan as he wrestles the gun out of his hands.
I don't understand.
Mr. Fan was beaten with a fan.
What is going on in this news story?
Well, a shooting suspect is badly hurt after he knocked down the door. Well, the man in the bedroom is waiting, and his weapon of choice, an oscillating fan. An oscillating fan. Well, the man in the bedroom is waiting, and his weapon of choice, an oscillating fan. An oscillating fan. Mr. Fan was greeted by a man armed with an oscillating fan. He beats the suspect down the stairs with the oscillating fan.
Fam like ham?
Right.
Okay.
Armed with an oscillating fan. Dong Fan.
Okay.
The victim of the fan attack.
Back up for a second.
An oscillating fan. An oscillating fan.
Okay.
Mr. Dong Fan. Ham with a P in front of it, which makes it a fan. An oscillating fan. An oscillating fan.
Okay.
An oscillating fan.
Stop.
Mr. Fan and the fan.
Stop.
Mr. Dong Fan.
Okay.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Emerson Show. We return tomorrow with a brand new program. This is the Emerson News Network.
Without further ado, Don Taylor presents Confidential to That Guy.
Confidential to the guy outside Fred Meyer last night. It was about 6 p.m. and you were going shopping with your son. He's adorable, by the way. He looks to be about 5 years old and appears well-behaved. Well done there. I was walking about 8 feet behind you as you approached the entrance to the store. You slowed briefly on the sidewalk, turned your head to the right, and spit. You just spit on the ground. I had to walk around it. And given that you didn't seem to pause to think about it, I'm fairly sure that you didn't think twice before you did it. Like a lot of men, you believe that it's perfectly all right to just hawk up saliva and expel it on the street anywhere you see fit. I say, like a lot of men, because I never see women do this. Only men. Walking down the street, standing in line at food carts, leaning out car windows, just letting fly with a wad of mucus. Why do you do that? Why do you think that's okay? Listen, if you want to expel viscous bodily fluids in the privacy of your own home, feel free. Spit up in your own yard all you like. Blow out a few tablespoons of snot onto your kitchen floor for all I care. Hork up a throat oyster onto your sofa and rub it into the fabric with your elbow. That's none of my business. But when you're in public, how about you try doing what civilized people do when they have an excess of moisture in their mouths? Swallow it. That's it. Just swallow it. It's not a big deal. Oh, and guy in front of Fred Meyer, you had your kid with you. Hell of a way to be a role model. Sincerely, Don.
There we go. The inaugural installment of Confidential to That Guy, courtesy of Don Taylor. And let me just read this. I think I have right here. So I got an email from a listener of ours who went to Christmas Mountain Treat. And it was our listener, Jason. And Jason says, Rick, wanted to let you know that as a listener, I try to use my part by utilizing the offerings and or services of your fine advertisers. I know that by buying, I'm helping to keep you talking for my entertainment, Rick, just like the radio monkey you love to be. That is true, sir. Says, today, my boyfriend and I went up to Christmas Mountain, and we had a great time. Weekdays are definitely the best. Says, no rain, but friendly, helpful, eager staff. We took our time selecting just the right tree, chatting with the owner. That would be Troy. He says, I wish only I had taken my flask with me for the tractor ride. That's not a thing that I can condone, endorse, promote, or encourage. Dawn, however, probably can. And Will?
I did not bring a flask with me, but now that you mentioned it, didn't even occur to me.
Well, then where was my wife getting the booze from?
It wasn't from me. Did Cheryl have a flask?
That's entirely possible. Well, somebody had a flask then. Because
and you just immediately assume it's me.
Well, you know, don't you have a cane that carries booze?
No, but I have a couple of different flasks.
Do they not make a cane that carries?
They have
a big straw for hooch?
It's a cane, and what it is you take the handle off of it, and there's two little plastic tubes that slide down into the cane proper, and they have screw tops on them, so you can put, and I think they hold like an ounce or two in each of those.
And there's a reservoir of liquor.
Yeah,
so
you can just unscrew the thing and pop out your little booze capsule.
Well, I don't know if this sort of a thing is illegal or not. It's private property. I mean, the Christmas Mountain trees belongs to Troy and Jennifer. They are the proprietors, so it seems like you could probably get all liquored up there. Maybe, maybe you want to, maybe you don't. I'm just saying.
So wait a minute. Your wife was getting booze somewhere and wielding a chainsaw.
Well, legally, no. Yes. Yes. The answer is yes. But legally, no. If you were to ask me.
Well, I'm sure she didn't have any booze until after.
That's right.
She handled the
chainsaw. That's exactly what I was going to say. I'm glad you came up with what I was going to come up with a few minutes from now by way of a justification. That's true, Dawn. That's exactly what. It's funny that you say that, even though that had not occurred to me as a thing that I should say, even though it is the truth.
So I think it's probably best to say the flask sounds like a good idea, but since there are axes and chainsaws and balers around, you don't need it.
Maybe later.
Yeah, you know, afterwards.
On the way home. Not on the way home.
I'm going to quit talking. They have hot cocoa and hot cider and coffee for free that they give you, and that's delightful.
This isn't ending up anything like I thought it was going to sound. Anyway, Jason says...
Damn it, Jason.
I wish only I had taken my flask with me for the... See, he's a sensible individual. He decided to wait.
Hi.
He says, it was the best Christmas tree hunting we have had since I've lived in Portland, and I've been here for 18 years. Just wanted to tell you that he, that would be Troy, spoke fondly of his experience with you guys on Saturday. Sorry we couldn't make it up there, but thanks for the recommendation. Longtime listener, Jason. So there you go. So Christmas Mountain Trees is the name of that fine family farm. Here's the thing. I distinctly remember somebody saying, Lara, can I... And I'm assuming this means what I think it means... Can I Irish up your coffee? Now, well, one doesn't wish to traffic in stereotypes, but I'm assuming that means make it alcoholic.
Yeah, that's what that would mean.
Yeah. Well, okay.
We did have, there were a couple of listeners there, and many of our listeners are fond of the tipple.
It was some sort of alcoholic Great Gazoo that just appeared out of nowhere.
Maybe it was one of the owners. Maybe it's not our fault at all.
There you go. That's as long as we are not in any way held responsible for the outcomes of our actions. You can find out more by going to ChristmasMountainTrees.com. ChristmasMountainTrees.com. They're open all the way through the 19th of December. You can also go to their Facebook page, Facebook.com/ChristmasMountain, where you can find weather reports, driving directions, and more. A fantastic Christmas tree farm owned and operated by that family for three going on four generations. ChristmasMountainTrees.com.
Where does the name Cujo come from?
From the Emerson News Network. This is Pop Culture Authority.
I'm Rick Emerson. Cujo. It's a name which comes freighted with menace. One which, in the seeming blink of an eye, went from being almost totally unknown to being eternally and inextricably linked with what was termed, quote, a sleeping evil crueler than death itself, end quote. The name Cujo was popularized, though that might be the wrong word, by the Stephen King novel of the same name in 1982. The novel Cujo, which largely takes place in a broken-down car over a series of sweltering hot days, is one of King's darkest novels, taking readers on a roller coaster ride that ends in a sort of bleak, abysmal plunge. And that name, Cujo, sounding Italian or Spanish or Indian or altogether unworldly, from where did that come? Now, the answer is just as compelling as the novel itself. Stephen King says the name comes from William Wolfe. And while you may not know the name William Wolfe, you know the deeds of the man. William Wolfe, you see, was a key member of the Symbionese Liberation Army,
the SLA, and one of the men responsible for Patty Hearst's kidnapping. The members of the SLA all had code names. Patty Hearst's was Tanya. Other code names were Yolanda, Zoya, and William Wolfe's code name was Cujo. So, yes, the dog who held a woman and her child hostage was named after a man who held a woman hostage. A man named Wolf, alias Cujo. This, by the way, is one of the few things King does recall about the novel Cujo. In his memoir, On Writing, he refers to it as a novel he, quote, barely remembers writing at all, end quote. It was written when King was in the depths of his addiction to alcohol. King also says that he likes the book and wishes he could remember enjoying the good parts as he put them down on the page.
The final word on the only knowledge that matters. Pop Culture Authority from the Emerson News Network.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Emerson Show. We return tomorrow with a brand new program. This is the Emerson News Network.
So this is your sort of an ad hoc clown watch, I guess, because there's some debate about whether the Insane Clown Posse counts as clowns. So we'll just, but we'll do this anyway, just for the sake of the bed. Now, many of you may have heard sections of this story. And Don, have you read the entire thing? I mean, do you know the gist?
I know the gist.
It really is good. I mean, the story is great in and of itself. Because it's got all the elements of a story. It's got clowns, it's got Tila Tequila, and then it's got people harming her physically.
That's the best part.
It really does.
It has feces.
Is there feces, really?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
I must have missed the feces.
That's one of the best parts of the story.
Excellent. And then
it also has a wrestler, we learned this morning.
And then it's got message board comments afterward. So I'm just going to read this to you. This is improbably enough from CNN. By Alan Duke of CNN. Headline is, Tila Tequila suffers cuts but escapes Juggalo's attack. It sounds like an Onion headline. I know people say that a lot about things. But, I mean, if you just picked up the Onion tomorrow and it said, and it said something like, Dan Rather escapes a savage beating at the hands of the Juggalos. I'm Doyle Redland. You'd be like, that's a great Onion story. Have you read this? But it's real, apparently. I mean, it's just, I don't understand this world of ours. It really is. It's sometimes that, like, parody cannot keep up. Reality TV, quote, star, end quote, Tila Tequila suffered. It's like I want to ring a bell every time something glorious happens that warms the cockles of my heart and then everybody drinks. Suffered facial cuts. That'd be the first bell right there. When she was pelted with rocks and bought, really?
Yeah.
Is that her?
That's a picture. She took a picture of her facial cuts.
Did she tweet that to everyone?
And she posted them online so people could see that she had bruises and facial cuts.
God bless you, Tila Tequila. She didn't have a tampon stringing hang out on that one, does she? Because every photo
probably. This is just from the shoulders up, so I'm sure that...
It's one of those things where, like, every third thing that she puts on Twitter, it seems like she's got to have some delicate, removal instrument hanging out of her area. Let's see. Verifying something here. All right, excellent. Okay, so there's the facial injury. Reality TV star Tila Tequila suffered facial cuts when she was pelted with rocks and bottles while performing at a music festival in Illinois early Saturday, according to a witness and law enforcement official. She's pretty cut up, said a performer who saw the violence at the Gathering of the Juggalos in rural Hardin County, Illinois. Like, I think it goes without saying that it's in a rural area, not in one of the tonier sections of town. The witness, this is the best phrase in the entire article. This, forget the fact that she was, like, pelted and beaten and that there's feces and clowns. And that she took her top off, and I think that actually encouraged them to beat her more. This is the best phrase in the article because it's said straight-facedly, and you know that it's meant with sincerity, but it's fundamentally absurd in ways I cannot even begin to express. She's pretty cut up, said a performer who saw violence at the Gathering of the Juggalos in rural Hardin County, Illinois. The witness asked not to be identified, so that he does not anger the Juggalos. Tequila, a Playboy model who also sings. It's interesting that they choose to phrase it that way. That's not me who said that. That's CNN.
It sings in quotes. Because I've seen the video, and she wasn't singing.
It posted a Twitter message Saturday saying she would sue the festival, which is organized for fans of the hip-hop group Insane Clown Posse. Pretty soon, the owners who run the Juggalos will be bankrupt, she tweeted.
They're going to lose all five cases of Faygo they own.
And it's also interesting that CNN has adopted tweet as an actual verb. And that it's not capitalized. Okay, somebody is going to get a talking to from the AP Stylebook editor about that. The fans are mostly young people who sometimes wear clown makeup and are referred to as Juggalos and Juggalettes. Festival organizers did not immediately respond to requests for response. The performers and a mob of hundreds chased tequila from the stage. I want you now to picture. I wish I had happy music. Hold on. Where's our happy music here? Let's see if I can just find a... the happy music I was playing earlier probably doesn't work. Let's see if I can just... we'll just do a little bit of this. Let's see if this works.
The video on YouTube of her being pelted with rocks seems to have disappeared.
Really?
TMZ had it from like four or five different angles earlier.
Hold on. Let me see if I've got the... No. Let's see. Where was the scary...
Yeah, there we go.
This almost works. Or maybe this. Hold on, I can try this one. Hold on, let me see if I can just... No. What's the appropriate bed to be playing here? Hold on, how about... This one almost works. The performer said a mob of hundreds chased tequila from the stage and surrounded the trailer where she sought refuge. They rocked the trailer and smashed its windows, the witness said. Tequila eventually escaped, but only after the windows in her SUV were smashed. Hardin County Sheriff Tom Siner, who offered a similar description of events, said he has an open investigation. It would be, quote, very hard to identify the attackers, he said. Unless he can locate video of the incident. Now, have you not seen the video, Don?
No, I haven't.
All the videos. It's awesome. Tequila offered her description of events in a statement to celebrity news website TMZ. Quote, I went on stage and immediately before I even got on stage, this is her word-for-word quote, dudes were throwing huge stone rocks in my face. Not just any rocks, stone rocks.
Huge. Ostensibly, they were also throwing feces at her.
Awesome. Beer bottles that slit my eye open. They almost burnt my hair because they threw firecrackers on stage. The witness, who was standing in the rear of the stage, said the crowd of 2,000 was immediately angry toward Tequila, and she was unable to win them over.
Apparently, according to other stories, halfway through it, she was standing behind security guards trying to use them as a human shield to protect her from rocks and feces. And the reason that she took her top off and flashed her breasts is she was actually trying to pacify the crowd by showing her breasts. And that is what did not work.
The rocks and bottles, Don, flew harder and faster when Tequila bared her breasts. She took her top off, and they got really violent, he said. Tequila continued to perform even after her face started bleeding. She was holding a towel to her head, blood pouring down her face. It was really scary, Tequila said. This was not the only violent incident at the festival early Saturday. A 49-year-old Georgia man was arrested for allegedly stabbing another man in the abdomen. So,
what is not in that story is that in the middle of that, Tom Green came out on stage and tried to pacify the crowd by doing the running man, which you can see on the video.
Tom Green also would just make me throw more feces.
TMZ had a quote this morning from a former WWE wrestler who was there performing at the Gathering of the Juggalos, yes. And his name was Colt Cabana. And when you go to his Twitter page, it includes a photo of him.
Looks like he's
straddling a mascot.
He's humping some kind of a big green mascot in the ring.
Oh, that is awesome.
That's his Twitter page. Dr. Colt Cabana.
Also at the Gathering of the Juggalos, Gallagher.
Oh, really?
Yes, also there this year.
I mean, you know,
how could you not be angered by that?
In a weird way, it makes sense.
It was like somebody got a copy of the Z List when they were booking this thing and said, nope, can't afford them. Who else you got?
I think you could get a gathering of any people anywhere, and if you gave them Tom Green, Tila Tequila, and Gallagher, they would become enraged.
Yeah.
A couple of people on Twitter yesterday I saw noted that this is probably the Juggalo Altamont.
Well, you know, the thing about the whole Juggalo festival they have or whatever every year is that, like, something like this happens every year. That's the deal. It's like I said about the Soapbox Derby. Every year, I expect them to say, well, this is the last year. You're not coming back again. Because this year there's some dickweed skateboarder who is skating down the hill. And, of course, there's big signs saying, like, stay off the track, you know. And there's huge, like, red and yellow. And there's cops and there's, like, police. It says, like, stay off the course. And there's ambulances everywhere, which should give you a clue of what might happen. But there's, you know, some dick skating down the hill. And the guy's like, get off the truck! And he disregards, and it was so deeply satisfying, though. He skated down the hill, and he, coming by us, and there's gonna be, like, big things that weigh hundreds of pounds coming down at, like, 60 miles an hour. Skateboarders coming down the hill, and the guy says, like, get off the track, it's dangerous. And the skateboarder just sort of does the whole, yeah, and waves him away. And then about 15 feet later, bam! Right off the skateboard and just ground himself down like a pencil eraser. It was awesome. They had to, the ambulance had to come and they had to load the guy. It was just so deeply gratifying. It was like an instant karma sort of, it was like the Monty Python foot coming right out of the heavens. But every year I expect him to say, like, okay, you know what? We're not going to let people be blind drunk on vodka going downhill at 60 miles an hour on roads lined with children in a thing they built in their garage while drunk. But they don't. And so every year the Juggalo thing, some guy gets stabbed, somebody gets, feces or stone rocks thrown at them.
Stone rocks.
And it's just, you know, and then they keep doing it. And I will say this before I read the message board comments. One of the great disappointments of my life, and it's not actually, the disappointment I'm referring to is not actually working at KUFO as such. But you remember at KUFO we did the whole Survive It and Drive It thing where there's the women who are living in the filth truck. One of the great disappointments of my existence one of the real big downers of my time at KUFO is that we came very, and I am not making this up, we came very close to having the Insane Clown Posse present in that parking lot in Vancouver to put like a bunch of, to perform with like, to put their monitor speakers like against the window of the truck and to do like a mini performance like 5 feet away from those girls until they snapped because they were in town. And Chris Paddock, the PD, like, knew their road manager or something. And we were going back and forth. We were like, look, what, and they were, you know, doing that thing where you try to grease them, you know, like, look, what if we play your single, like, a few times, like, late at night, you know, like, not a lot, but just enough to, what if we give some tickets away or something? And we came, like, this close to having the Insane Clown Posse there in the parking lot in Vancouver. Think of how perfect an American this would, you're talking about how it's, Don, that it's perfect that there's Gallagher and a wrestler. Think of how perfect it would have been to have the Insane Clown Posse serenading some girls in a truck filled with garbage in Vancouver in a parking lot. I mean, it would have been like...
Well, no, we were trying to think of things that would, like, you know, drive them mad and drive them... And my suggestion was to just surround the car with clowns.
Yeah.
Obviously, you took that...
But these would be insane clowns.
Insane clown posse. Even better.
So I am really disappointed that I... Because I'm telling you right now, don't think Rick Emerson's a snob. I would have eaten that up. You tell me if we couldn't get the Insane Clown Posse there, I'd still be there taking photos with them. That would have been awesome.
Well, at 11:25 a.m., by the way, on her Twitter, Tila Tequila did say, go to TMC.com. Violence against women like myself or anyone for that matter is not okay, she said. So
well, that's her
take
story.
It from Tila Tequila.
Violence is bad.
I'm sure that battered women everywhere appreciate the alliance with Tila Tequila.
Violence against women like herself or anyone for that matter.
So blah, 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 Insane Clown Posse. I have to say, just before I read these comments, though, I really do kind of dig those guys because they are, it's not like I'm a fan or whatever, but you got to admire those guys who have really made something. I mean, something, I don't think people really appreciate how much money that organization makes. And it is effectively just run by those two guys and their manager. I mean, that is, you know, and there was that controversy back in, I think, the mid-90s where they were on Hollywood Records and then they got dumped before the record ever came out. And so they got a little bit of scandal to start their career. But, you know, it's not like anybody's playing their videos or there's a radio station anywhere at all playing their music. They are in almost every way. Insane Clown Posse, which is now, you think about it, they have record labels, they have multiple bands underneath them, you know, artists underneath them that they put out on their own label. They have made multiple films, they tour, they have a goddamn convention with like 20,000 people every year. And That effectively has sprung from nowhere. I mean, that is like a grassroots phenomena, whatever people want to say about it.
When I lived in Portland, in North Portland, there was a house about a block away from me that I drove by every once in a while that was a bunch of Juggalo kids living there. They'd often be hanging out on their front porch.
Bill Cosby's new cartoon. Hey, kids, it's Juggalo time!
They'd be hanging out on the front porch, though,
I got some
their
feces.
Juggalo outfits and their makeup. And, and we drive by it, and it's like that's one of those moments when you realize how like middle-aged you actually are. When I'm driving by with my husband, and we just look at them
kids.
And go, oh, no, it was almost like affection, like, look at the Juggalos.
Look at the adorable.
Isn't that adorable?
Yeah, you know, and I just...
Isn't that cute?
And it's like, you know, and this is one of those things, too, where it's like the... It's not even a guilty pleasure thing, because it's not like I'm a big Insane Clown Posse fan or something, but it's that thing where I catch people in my generation turning into their parents, and I always try to very politely correct them. When people are like, Insane Clown Posse is retarded, like, we'll say the guy with, like, a Kiss t-shirt. And I'd say, like, if you have ever in your life dressed as a member of Kiss, like, if you have ever dressed as a musician, if you have ever in your life painted your face in any way, if you painted your face to look like Ziggy Stardust, you are never again allowed to criticize the Insane Clown Posse, because then you have just become like your own grandfather. So you
lose perspective. I maybe it's just that we lose perspective in general nowadays, because, you know, we look at everything in a micro sense. But like on the Lady Gaga story the other day, somebody put a comment on Oregon Live that said, another example of the dumbing down of America. It's like, well, no, this comment is because she's a pop star. There have always been pop stars. There always will be pop stars doing something different. There's nothing dumb about her. It's complicated to get into the clothes that she gets into. She writes catchy pop songs. They're pretty good. She's got a decent voice.
You know, but it's that whole thing about, you know, like, we're living in an era of the most vacuous music on earth. And it's like, that is like, you have become old if you ever said that, like that. And I'm not saying that I'm, like, down with all the kids or whatever, but at the same time, I don't just blindly, like, I did not grow up with it, therefore it sucks.
It might be like, Juggalos are probably a lot like pit bulls. Most of them are well-behaved, but, you know, it's the few bad ones that ruin the entire...
Ixnay on the it bull.
No, I agree with him. He's being correct. Most pit bulls are delightful. But yes, the occasional bad apple pit bull, it gives the rest of them a bad name.
Juggalos are not good pets, is what I'm saying.
If there's someone in this room who will occasionally have a lot of anger about the pit bull issue. I don't want to say who it is, but it's Dawn. So just be careful. I'm just saying.
I was afraid that was going to go in a wrong. I was going to afraid you that the wrong thing was going to come out of your mouth, and then it was going to be blood in the carpet. All right, let me read these Juggalo comments. I find myself saying the weirdest things on the show. And then we'll blah, blah, blah. All right, just random comments just from the CNN message board. So these are people who have somehow gotten onto the Intertron and managed to post. There's just no particular order. They should have booked Betty White instead. Followed by, this is a pathetic article. First off, what the hell is Tila Tequila doing at an ICP event? That actually does bear
her management needs to bear some responsibility.
Because I don't know why you would ever have booked her there in the first place. That actually doesn't make any sense.
Well, Tom Green, Gallagher. They had this guy, Colt Cabana, who apparently was coming out to play the role of a cop kind of a sketch.
But here's the thing. That all does make sense. Because, you know, there is like they have a whole wrestling offshoot of the Insane Clown Posse. Like, their empire, I'm not effing around when I say that it's a massive,
Gallagher. Explain a 60-year-old man smashing watermelons at a Juggalo.
Do you want to take this or should I? I can tell you why.
He makes a mess. They make messes.
That's their whole thing, is they have a whole thing about spraying the audience with food and beverages and whatever. You know, and their
he
whole thing is spraying them with
Faygo
soda.
Bottles.
Yeah. I mean, it is part and parcel of what they do. It makes sense.
He's not that good.
Tom Green is untalented and loud and obnoxious, and they are as well.
Yeah, he's like fart humor that makes, you know, he's, you know, it makes money and makes adolescent boys
chuckle.
Well,
there you go. Tila Tequila. Untalented, obnoxious.
They must have just figured it was like the boobs factor, maybe. Or that, I would not actually, because they are savvy enough business people, I would actually not put it past them to have realized that this or something like this would have happened, and they couldn't get Jessica Simpson.
Maybe Emmylou Harris was booked.
Let's see. If you're being pelted, here we go. If you're being pelted with feces, why would you continue to expose yourself? Okay, that's a fair question, too. Why would you expose more of your skin to the fecal matter? How about this? Tila Tequila is the Sarah Palin of the CNN entertainment section. She just has to show up somewhere, and she's instantly on the front page of the CNN website. Who does her agent know at CNN? Followed by, This is what she gets for murdering her girlfriend. Oh, that's awesome. That
the best one. My favorite comment yesterday, and I can't remember which of the many, many, many websites I was reading about this on yesterday while I was hanging out in my basement, but was just projectiles. How do they work?
You know, the thing about her murdering her girlfriend is, you know, that's a whole thing about her and Casey Johnson. They were together, and that actually was responsible for the single best celebrity tweet that has ever existed, which is Tila Tequila. She said of the tweet after Casey Johnson died, where she said, I'm quoting now. This is after Casey Johnson died, Tila Tequila said, "Everything we ever did was spend time together. That's why her location, she always put my fiancé's bed. It pains me," Tila wrote on Twitter after Johnson died. "We used to send tweet messages to each other while laying next to each other in bed. But now I tweet alone." End quote.
There you go.
"I tweet alone" is the best phrase that's ever been put on the Internet. Final comments here. Let's see. This is why the Taliban hates us. And this one's just for Dawn. I don't know who this I don't know what extraction the commenter is. It says, "Did she died? The clowns make the girl go boom boom." I am quoting now from CNN.com. "Did she died? The clowns make the girl go boom boom," and she gets all caps "cut," and then all caps again, and "cut" with like five U's, all caps again, "no, to the Tila, I am so cry," winky emoticon, "someone call police 0911, Tila, Tila, you so strong, you so brave, clowns so wrong. Tila, Tila, sing my song all day."
Oh, is there a name
there
for
you go.
The person
was
who
that
wrote
Shaggy
that?
And or Too Dope?
It is from Rubinkus, something there. All right, so there you go. So, Tila, you're so strong. Clowns, so wrong.
The Juggalo Altamont.
Jesus, God. All right, I'll tell you what. Dawn, step down for a moment. We'll take a little break. Come back with your top five. Now we've kept you for like 9 hours. We're here with Ryan White from the Oregonian. Read him in print in the Oregonian online at OregonLive.com. We will come back after this. The Rick Emerson Show continues next right here on the Emerson News Network. Don't go anywhere.
Be my Valentine. He was gonna be mine.
Ladies and gentlemen, you all know my next guest. To say the phrase living legend, to use a phrase like towering rock and roll god, applies to a small handful of people in this world. But certainly this next man is one of those people. Let us now welcome to the Rick Emerson Show the one, the only, the legendary Peter Criss. Hi, Peter.
Hi, that's a hell of a bring on. I don't know if I could top that. That's pretty good.
No pressure. Don't worry about it. No, I have to say, and if you will allow me just a small moment of what they call fanboy geeking, I got to tell you, to talk to you, Peter Criss, really is the fulfillment of a lot of dreams. And as you know, you made a very strong imprint on a whole lot of people. I mean, generation after generation after generation. I mean, the fathers handing down to sons and sons handing down to grandchildren. And when you, I mean, do you hear that every day? You must, when people say to you, look, it's, you know, you're the reason, you're the guy that got me going, you're the guy who was my inspiration. When you make music now, do you make it just for yourself, or are you doing your own thing right now? Do you feel the weight of being the kind of a living legend?
Well, I hate that word. It scares me. I try not to think about all that stuff. You know, it's like when I was, you know, younger guy and all that, that was like, you know, a lot of, it does get to be heavy, and it could be very ego. Your ego could really get inflated and your brains could blow up. So today, this Peter Criss, I'm not delusional. I really try to keep my feet on the ground, and I never do music only but for the people that hear it. It's not for myself. I'm not that selfish. There is a selfishness in it that when I write and compose, yes, it's pretty much, you know, about my situations that I come and go through in life and things, loss or gain or something or other. They're usually little mini stories, I call them, about my life, but always with the people who put me in this situation today never leave my mind. I mean, I am so grateful to God, since I am a Catholic kid and I was raised pretty cool, and I don't, my fans, when they come up to me and say, especially kids, young kids come up and say, man, I'm playing the drums because of you, it flips me out. It still flips me out.
Your new record is called One for All. That is the new Peter Criss record, and I know, now is it Paul Schaefer, is it this record that Paul Schaefer is actually working, and you produced it too, right? You were actually in the chair, you were the man at the head of the helm.
Yeah, I felt, only because this has been in the works for 2 years because of the touring and off, and it was the last tour, and I wanted to get to it. And Michael McLaughlin, first of all, wrote most of the stuff with me. Me and this guitarist go back to 91, and he's now in China. He lives, believe it or not, and he comes back and forth and stays in my guest house. So he had a lot to do with that. And when we started doing this and we saw the form it was going to take, and especially the songs I chose and where I wanted to really go on uncharted land, I worked with the great Ezrin and the great Ponzi and the Kramers, and I figured if I could do this, if they, you know, I learned a lot from those guys, and I had so much help with the engineers, and again, let's bring up Paul Schaefer, and I go way back to the Saturday Night Live days. I had a very close friend of mine, John Belushi. We were good buddies, and it was a great crowd then, and so we knew each other. And then when this came up, it easily came to my mind, if I'm going to do something by Santos, Stephen Santos, or redo a song for my mom, like What a Difference a Day Makes, or I need a guy who can play a Hammond organ and a piano, and I immediately thought of Paul. And so Mike and I went up to Paul's office at the Ed Sullivan Theater and said, what do you think it is? And he said, this is some serious stuff, man. You really got big ones to try this. You know, not everybody's going to get it, but, man, I get it, and I would be proud. And I said, well, while we're at it, can I get Will Lee, who has got to be one of the best bass players on the planet? And Will and I are like infectious friends. We can't get on the phone enough with each other. And with that, I needed an arranger, and he got me Clifford Carter, who's done a lot for Neil Diamond and Sting and stuff. And I've always wanted to do a duet with a gal, preferably Aretha Franklin, but she wasn't available. So I got this terrific gal named Jen Johnson. And the joy of it all was sitting there and working with kids. I got to work with a great urban choir of kids that were just sensational on the song One for All, which is all about 9/11. And so it was a real comfortable atmosphere. The nuts and bolts was done here in my home. I have a studio built downstairs. And then we took all the rest of it to New York for the mixing, which George Marino mastered it. He did Lennon and Hendrix and Kiss. And
early stuff of mine. He's just really brilliant guy. So it was all kind of very loosely done. I didn't tell anybody, you know, you got to play this and you got to play that. I know how that feels, and it's not a great feeling. I'm not going to tell Paul Schaefer how to play or will. And they kind of just do, and, you know, maybe now and then I'd suggest something. But everybody just had a great loose time about it, but yet knew the seriousness of it.
We're talking to the one and only Peter Criss, and your new CD is called One for All. And actually, you hit on something that I wanted to mention, which is you have a real strong... and even though I'm from the West Coast, you have a real strong New York sensibility. I mean, you always have. You know, even back to stuff like a song like Hooligan off Love Gun, which is one of the great songs, just has a real swing to it. And it's I hate to use a word like street because that sounds so cliche, but it is a real city feel to it. And is that a thing that you were consciously trying to bring? Did you feel like you wanted to feel like the New York sound was really being represented, or is that just who you are?
I think it's who I am. You know, I'm a kid from the streets. I was born in Brooklyn, poor neighborhood. Mom and dad, and I had a brother, three sisters, lived in four rooms, Coldwater Flat, tough neighborhood. But yet, you know, the music was there. My mother, rest her soul, who I wouldn't be doing all this if she wasn't so important in my life to keep pushing me to get me with the music, knowing that's the only key out of Brooklyn. And you know, I don't think it ever. You could take, as they say, the kid out of Brooklyn, but you can't take Brooklyn out of the kid. So, you know, I was a pretty tough guy when I was young, and I think a lot of that street stuff, when I started hanging out in Greenwich Village, when it was a cool time to be there, when, like, say, you know, the late 60s, and you had Hendrix and the Doors, and then the first time the British invasion, and it was hopefully all that has rubbed off on me, and now and then it does come out of me. I think it's important being a guy from New York.
Talking to Peter Criss, do you feel like some of that, the sort of, the, you know, because New York has, there's so much, there's such a romance to that city where there's the Gershwin and the Cole Porter.
We get Broadway.
And absolutely, the Great White Way, and New York also has sort of that seamy underbelly. There's a lot of grit and a lot of grime, especially in an earlier era. Do you feel like the mix of those two things, maybe that there's some of that, New York has a lot of that sort of instability where things in that city always feel a little tumultuous. Do you feel like that was a mixed blessing to you, the fact that there was a little tumult always kind of going on in the city that maybe rubbed off on you where things were?
Yes, very good. Very cool. Yeah, New York is very potpourri, man. We've got, I'm Irish-Italian. There's German, Irish-Italian, Indian, black, green, blue, orange. It's like major stuff, you know, musical stuff always even going around in the air. If you walk through New York, you'll hear all kinds of stuff going on. And I lived in L.A., by the way, for 13 years. So, you know, great place, different kind of mentality, different type of stuff. Where I think a kid for me, where I grew up, again, in near the Great White Way, that grease taint must have rubbed off on me because I always saw it in a different artistic light. When I started the band with the guys, we wanted it more than just, you know, guys up there in jeans and a T-shirt. I saw it much, much more. I wanted to be in the band that I wanted to be in. That's kind of how it worked out.
We're talking to the one and only Peter Criss. This, I know that the new record, One for All, you said it's very autobiographical, a lot of things, the moments in your life that you address, whether the high moments, low moments. What are some of the key moments in your life that you wanted to talk about on this record? What are some of the moments you felt like, hey, this has got to be in a song, this has got to be something I sing about?
Well, I wrote one of the songs is called Faces in the Crowd, and it was a great movie. My late dear friend Stan Penridge, who wrote Beth with me, loved the movie. And the title stuck in my head for some reason. Some songwriting, there is no rules. You can write a chorus. You can write the bridge first. You can write the lyrics first. You can write the title. You can write the ending before the beginning. That's the greatness of writing. And I had the title stuck in my head. And one night, the last maybe the 10 years of my life, I've never realized how so important, as you say, kids, and the people in my audience go from 1 to 100, and you're absolutely right. Their kids and their kids are there, and their kids are there. It's just amazing. And I, many nights, spent looking out from the curtain out to these people of their faces and the joy and the ups and downs, especially when I come out to sing Beth. Oh, my God, I would see girls just break down crying, and it just overwhelmed me. And this song, I had it when I wrote it, I found that after a show, a musician, you go back to your room, you're all by yourself. It's a very low period for me, and it's quiet, and there's no more hoopla and screaming, and everybody leaves you alone. And the song came to me then, and I felt that's exactly right. You're in the room, but I kind of wanted to transport myself in time back to the stadium, which I do. There was a lot of magic in the studio how we did that, but it goes back to the screaming and the auditorium and the loudness, and then it quiets down again, and the song is truly saying that the spotlight is far from on me. It's really on the fans, and they are really the stars. And that really came from the heart, and the words were really chosen very, very carefully, same as Memories is a whole tune, kind of through all the years I've been through with the fans of the roller coaster great ride we've been on. So a lot of sentiment stuff in here, man.
We're talking to Peter Criss. The new CD is called One for All. And after, obviously, Kiss and then solo career, and then you did acting. You were on Oz, right? The HBO show, and you were on Oz.
Was that too cool? You know, I just got a book they put out, and I wanted to see, and I had my name, and I was so in awe that I did that. That was one of the best times of my life. I went to acting school for a while, 2 years, actually, and I even got my equity card, which had a lot to do with some of the way I'm even singing on this album, like Sending the Clowns from Santa, and a few tunes, because I took, I never thought I would take voice lessons, but if you're going to go on Broadway and sing 7 nights a week, you better have that throat.
When
you know what you're doing with it. So I had a little more knowledge now about how to use my voice a little more. I guess you're never too old to learn.
When you were acting, is that a thing? Did you feel like you had something to prove, or was it just one more thing that you wanted to do? Is it something?
Oh, man, I am a cinema guy. I wanted to do that. I wanted to act forever. And I don't mean Kiss Meets the Phantom. I wanted to do some serious stuff, and I still do. I still get scripts sent to me. I find it was so cool to not be Peter Criss and to beat a bunch of guys up with a baseball bat and then spend the day in prison and then go home at night to bed. It was really, to me, the most sensational feeling, because you really jump out of your skin and you could be some other guy for a while. It was very, very cool.
We're talking to Peter Criss on One for All. The final cut, the closing cut, is actually, is it with Ace? Is it about Ace? A little bit of both?
A little bit of both. It's I got a few chords there, and I started embellishing it, and I started getting really spacey with it, and came to mind was Ace, because we were really on tour for a long time, and the plane we were on after a while did feel like a spaceship, and I do believe he's an alien. I don't believe he's really from this.
It's from Jendel.
Yeah, that's exactly right, my friend. And it kind of, I started writing lyrics as jokingly, but they started making sense to me, and I guess from A to Z, it all fell together. And next thing, I'm singing a tune about one of my bandmates who's perfectly good to sing about, because he is all those things and more. So,
you know, for a guy who is from Brooklyn, as you said, grew up in the Coldwater Flat and just went from nothing to everything. If I can ask this, what was the moment? What was the one moment, whether you were by yourself, in front of the fans, whatever, the moment when you first knew you went, okay, this is it. I am on that roller coaster.
I've got that story down, Cole. And it'll be eventually in my book when I do finish it. I passed Madison Square Garden when I was a boy with my mom, and I said, "Hey, Ma, you know, I'm going to play that place someday." You know, like, right. And it came. Now I've played it many times, and the first time I played it, I walked out on the stage to do Beth, and I looked over to the left of me, and my mom and dad were sitting in a box, and they were crying like kids, which almost made me break down. And I knew right then and there I made it. I knew that's what I wanted to do in this world, was to let my parents see me on top of the world, especially at Madison Square Garden. The
Sure.
greatest champions in the world had been there. And to see them see me there was, I said to myself, okay, everything else is cream.
I can't top that. I can't. There's no way to follow that up. Peter Criss, the new CD is called One for All. Is there a website, URL, MySpace, anything?
Yes, please, petercriss.net. Please, you know, go on there. I'll let you know what I'm doing. I'm not selling you coffins or anything. I'm just selling you good news. I'm not selling you nothing bad. I'm selling you, you know, what this Christian kid's doing and what I'm up to.
Excellent.
I did finish, by the way, over the winter, 13 brand new rock and roll songs.
Excellent.
That I'll put out next year, a rock album. And I actually finally finished my swing album dedicated to Gene Krupa, and I have to mix that.
So that is so great.
I've been busy.
My friend, I got to tell you, from someone who loves music to someone who makes music and continues to, it's been an honor and a pleasure. The album is called called One for All. Ladies and gentlemen, the one and only Peter Criss. Thank you, Peter.
Oh, you're a gentleman. God bless you. This is very nice. You were very cool. Thank you so much, man.
Thank you so much. Peter Criss. Scotty, if you want to wrap that up with him, that would be so great. Thank you so much. Peter Criss, ladies and gentlemen.
That was awesome. That's childhood dream come true.
Checking it off the list. Ah, that's so cool. I was so nervous going into that. The first couple of questions.
I have never seen you nervous. You were nervous.
I
could tell you were kind of pacing and you looked a little, I could see that you were thinking about what you were going to say next before you said it.
About a third of the way in, I sort of, I sort of relaxed. Yeah. That is so cool. All right. Fantastic. What a cool guy, man.
That's so neat.
How great is that?
I loved his little
that story about his parents. That story about his parents. Mm-hmm. Is that great? That Madison Square Garden thing?
Oh, yeah.
What a cool guy. He was badass, man.
No, I'm on his website right now.
Oh, and it's just, and I'm totally a sucker for New York stories. I am totally just a stuck, he's like the Brooklyn guy. And he's got the great, cool Brooklyn accent. He's got that kind of cool Goodfellas thing going on.
Well, he doesn't seem affected by it.
No, and he's just, and talk about a guy. I mean, you can say whatever you want about, the 2007 and all the things that Kiss went through. Everything that, that happened with that band up and down, For that guy to be that cool and that down to earth, I mean, do you realize? I don't have the figure in front of me, but I'm pretty sure it's 90. Yeah, here we go. Listen to this. Kiss has sold 80 million records in their career. They have earned 55 gold, platinum, and multi-platinum record. They are the largest selling group in the history of the world, I think, behind the Beatles. I think it is the Beatles, then Kiss. And I think in terms of performers, I think they are third after the Beatles and Garth Brooks. They've sold 80 million records.
Damn.
And that guy, for him just to be so, for him just to be so cool and just so straight up like that and everything. And so, anyway.
Have you ever talked to anybody from Kiss before?
No, that's it. I mean, the closest I've ever come is... let's see. No, I never talked to Tommy Thayer even. The closest I've ever come is having those Kiss liners cut that we've been playing all week.
Well, people don't even know. They think that you're some kind of like superficial fan. They don't see you parading around in your Kiss t-shirts every day.
Oh, dude.
Or like they don't see right here.
But I've got Kiss dolls in the studio.
Oh, they're attached to the thing.
Yeah. You can't actually rattle against the microphone.
Our studio is lined with Kiss dolls.
Yeah, over against the window, we actually have all of the Kiss action figures over there. And I, so who knows? Who knows how he feels about that? So you heard that crack he made at the end about Gene selling the caskets.
Oh, that was what I was going to comment. That was hilarious.
Excellent.
So are they friends still? Or?
I think there's some estrangement there. I think that's the diplomatic way probably to put that. But you know what? It, at this point, and then I'll quit just kind of geeking out about it. Because we otherwise I'm just going to sit and geek all day and we'll get nothing done. We're already into the news hour. I just got to say this. Kiss to me is like Prince, Madonna, the Rolling Stones. Anybody. In fact, we made this observation about Madonna a while back. That, she's nothing to prove. I mean, Peter, Chris, those guys, because they have nothing to prove to anybody. They were the biggest band on earth for a long time. They went away. They came back in that reunion tour in 96 and were the biggest band on earth again. And I got to tell you, for a guy, and that was the first time I'd ever seen them, for a guy who grew up listening to them, only heard the legends, the myths. I only heard the stories. It was like some sort of a tale of Sisyphus passed down throughout the years. And then to actually see them live, I will tell you, to this day, I mean, 10 years, 11 years later, the opening moments at that Kiss reunion show that I saw in 96, that is transcendent. It is the greatest moment of my music life, probably. I mean, as far as seeing something live, certainly. I mean, because... It's just impossible to overstate the level of, it just starts to sound so gay, but we were just, everybody in that stadium was just floating. I mean, there was just not, you didn't even feel like you were on Earth at that moment because it was a thing you had only ever heard about. And see, you're not that much younger than I am, but I think there's enough of an age gap there that you probably don't remember a world without Kiss being around. Walking around now on TV in whatever. There was a long time when Kiss was sort of around without makeup, but you didn't really feel like it was Kiss, and you only heard the stories about what their old makeup era concerts were like. And then to actually see it, I mean, it was like in my head, it was like the only thing I can compare seeing that Kiss reunion concert to in 96, the only thing I can compare that to is when the new Star Wars film came out in 99.
Uh-huh.
Before you saw it, when you Phantom Menace, when you saw the trailer for the Phantom Menace, that's the only thing I can compare.
I need to borrow that from you.
What?
Well, I was thinking the Phantom in the Park, whatever.
No, Kiss Meets the Phantom in the Park. Yeah, see that maybe after you've had a few.
Okay.
That's. I think there's a European cut of that on the Kiss DVD we're giving away. Let's get this one call quickly. Hi, you're on the Rick Emerson Show. Hello.
Hey, Rick.
What's
just
up?
Just wanted to let you know from an audience perspective here, a little Insta poll. Man,
yes,
everything
sir.
From chills to a lump in the throat. Great
Thank
interview.
You. He was a cool guy. He really yeah, was.
Absolutely. And I think you managed to really capture an entire span of you know everything from the personal to some of the fun geeky stuff.
Excellent.
So just job well done, my friend.
Thank you.
Way to go, team.
Thank you, my friend. I appreciate it. All right, there you go. That's Frank. Thank you.
This has been the Best of the Rick Emerson Show. We return tomorrow with a brand new program. This is the Emerson News Network.